Today is September 3rd, 2014. This is the Board of Public Works. Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer, any opening thoughts?
Thank you, Governor. Good morning, Treasurer Kopp. I hope everyone had a great Labor Day weekend, which, as some of you may have figured out, for me, always is, always has been, and always will be the logical end to the summer season. I, in fact, have launched a petition drive a few weeks ago to start Maryland public schools after Labor Day to allow the overwhelming bipartisan movement of families, rank-and-file teachers, students, and small businesses to speak directly to the new governor and the new legislature in January when the General Assembly convenes. We've collected nearly 5,000 signatures so far. You're all welcome to go to www.marylandtaxes.com and sign on if you wish. We're collecting them the old-fashioned way. In addition, with about 100 supporters gathering signatures at restaurants, supermarkets, fairgrounds, and in neighborhoods throughout the state. I myself stood on the boardwalk in Ocean City. I almost got trampled holding my petition out with people coming over saying, sign us up. The bottom line is that there's an overwhelming support out there for this common sense adjustment that's good for families, good for teachers, good for the small businesses whose tax revenues support the nation's best public school system and who truly are at the heart and soul of the Maryland economy. So our kids won't miss out on the summers we had, cherish, so families aren't denied the precious summer time together, and so teachers aren't deprived of the time they deserve to earn extra money with a second job or, frankly, just spend time with their own kids and recharge their batteries from stressful teaching. And so small businesses who have taken their share of hits lately can get a needed break. And I particularly like the fact that this important reform can be done at no cost to the taxpayers. So I'd respectfully ask each of you, if you'd like to, join the movement and let summer be summer by signing our petition. Governor, it's a pleasure to see you. I understand you even think that this
might be
good.
I'll sign your petition.
Good. Hang on, I'll get one sent over.
I'm sure that. In fact, I'm tempted to do an executive order extending summer by another month.
Hold on there.
Madam Treasurer?
I think it was fine until last week. I'm ready for autumn now. It's a pleasure to be here. I must say that celebrating Labor Day, this is just Nancy Kopp comment, celebrating Labor Day brings home what's happening to the state of labor, not just in Maryland, but in this nation, and the growing disparity amongst our people and the important but overlooked role that labor, not just blue-collar labor, but hard-working American middle-class people play in our economy and society. And I just am very, very concerned about where we're going. And the fact that we celebrate Labor Day not by thinking about the role of labor, but by going out and spending money and having barbecues, I have never found quite as exciting as some. But there you go. It's good to be here.
All righty. The Secretary's agenda. Is this where the one that Mr. Gill has?
We have agenda. Secretary of Natural Resources can come up for item 8.
Okay. Item 8. Let's take item 8 first off the bat here. Item 8 on the Secretary's agenda. Mr. Secretary?
Thank you, Governor. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Governor. It is my privilege to ask the Board of Public Works to approve naming the visitor center at Patapsco Valley State Park, the William Offutt Johnson Visitor Center. I will tell you in a moment why I'm making that recommendation, but with me today are Mr. Johnson, who passed away a year ago, his daughter Jenna and her husband Larry, and their two children, Joshua and Bethany, and various friends and supporters. Offutt Johnson worked for the Department of Natural Resources for 35 years. First as a planner in forests and parks, later as the Assistant Director of Program Open Space, and finally, for the last 7 years, as a park naturalist at Patapsco. The Visitor Center is a 19th century, 150-year-old stone dwelling. Mr. Johnson worked tirelessly to restore the house. The project was basically unfunded, and he, working with the park manager, organized a nonprofit Friends of Group to raise funds and receive donated services to complete the work. After he retired, he continued to volunteer, helping him, among other things, to establish a foundation for Maryland conservation history. Mr. Johnson was an inspiration to those who knew him. He always said that his work was not a job, but a way of life. Shortly before he died, a year ago this past July, he had a conversation with our former Green Ridge State Forest manager, Francis Zumbrick, who is with us today. He said to Francis, "You know, we talk about the crown jewels of parks, the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, and Yellowstone. But let me tell you, from the smallest tot lots to the largest parks, they are all jewels in the crown. They are all special places." We asked the board to name the Visitor Center in Patapsco Valley Park, State Park, itself a special place after this special man.
Okay, do we want to hear from any family members? Come on up. That's okay. Bring the kids. Bring the whole family up, because we're going to do a picture as soon as you're done, as soon as you share your reflections with us.
He was the one who did all the talking. All my life, whenever we would go on vacations or trips, we would always go to visitor centers. And now he's gone, and he's getting me to another visitor center. Because I'll have to, it'll be named after him. I just thank you all so much for doing that. He loved the outdoors. He grew up in Cumberland, Maryland, and his dad was a forester, and it's his life. That was his pride and joy. He loved being out there and making places for people to go.
Well, I want to thank you for everything that you and your family and your dad has done for all of us, because some of the nicest people, and I've met a lot of nice people in our state, but some of the nicest are people like your dad who work in the Department of Natural Resources, who take care of the parks, who connect us with the other living systems of this beautiful place we call Maryland. And I hope this is some comfort and some small tribute to the love that your dad gave all of us in his life. And I hope the grandkids appreciate what a great guy they had as a grandfather. So why don't you all come on up? We'll do a picture all together. Oh, let's do the boat first.
That's a great
How
picture.
About that? That is a great picture. Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? It's unanimous. Come on around for a picture.
Come on up.
Good morning.
What do we have? We have the sign?
Yes, sir.
What's your name, pal?
Joshua.
Joshua, say hi to Comptroller Francho. Hey, thank you. Come up front and center. What's your name, honey? What is it? Hello, Bethany. Come on up.
Hi.
Larry, good to meet you. Come on, say it. Come on up the center. Come on. Front. All the way up. All the way up. There we go. You guys get to hold that. Maybe you want to come out here. Everybody squeeze together. Colleagues here, come on. Come on, second row. Yeah. Mr. Baker is going to put this online with all of his great works.
Okay,
And there's more to that symphony. Yeah, don't be shy about asking. If you want more of the signs, we've got more of it. Sure. It's a poor state that can't afford a duplicate. Thank you, folks. Thank you for your good work. I meant what I said, too.
Thank you.
Okay, also on the Secretary's agenda, we have a number of people here. I see Ted Mack, who's the head of our African-American Heritage Commission.
And item 20, yes.
So this is item 20.
And we have,
thank you.
We also, I think Mayor Sanders might be here as long as it is.
And Mayor Sanders from the town of Highland Beach, all part of this same item, right, Mr.
Yes.
Mack? Thanks. Tell us what we have here.
We have Mayor Sanders from Highland Beach, the historic Highland Beach, which is one of the first incorporated cities in this state.
Stay close to that microphone, Mr. Mack. Your soft-spokenness doesn't always come over the Internet.
Okay. And I want to introduce William Sanders III, and he will tell you about this wonderful project that he has going on to preserve the history of that historical place.
Awesome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I will be very succinct. I will tell you that one of the privileges that I have in serving as mayor is also continuing the legacy of the town of Highland Beach, and in particular of Frederick Douglass. We have in our community the Frederick Douglass Museum and Cultural Center. That's a building that was not built to be a cultural center. It was built to be a home for Frederick Douglass. Built in 1895, unfortunately, he died before he could move in, but he had a hand in developing that particular property and intended to move in. Unfortunately, it's a very, very small building, and we have many, many visitors that come to learn about the history, to learn about the legacy of African Americans in the state of Maryland, as well as the history of Frederick Douglass and Highland Beach. Because it's so small, what we want to do is to create what we call a museum annex in our town hall. We have a floor in the town hall that is undeveloped, and this will be a place where those artifacts that cannot be exhibited in the town in the museum would be housed there. So visitors to the museum could actually come to the museum and see what the museum house is about, and then walk down a couple of blocks to our town hall and go upstairs on our second floor in the museum annex and get a sense of what was happening around the turn of the century. So that's the project, and we're very appreciative of being here, and thank you all.
Great. Thank you.
Mayor, I should know this, and I'm embarrassed that I don't. But
and I better know it then.
No. Between the two buildings,
yes.
Walking from, what do you pass? I mean, how do you go?
The Frederick Douglass Museum and Cultural Center is on Chesapeake Bay. So if you've not been to the community, it's right across from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation building. That's our neighbor. We're separated by something called Black Walnut Creek. But if you walk down two blocks along the bay and then turn up Douglass Avenue, named, of course, for Frederick Douglass, and go up another two blocks, you'll come to the town hall.
So there's a way to make an entire community out of that campus, as it were.
Yes, absolutely. And we do have some other projects in mind to signify the historic significance of many of the homes. There are 31 homes in the community that are historic homes, and we have projects in the works for those as well.
I've got to come down.
Yes,
very good.
Please, we'd be happy to have you.
I've been to that home that Frederick Douglass anticipated retiring in. And in his writings, he said he looks forward to sitting on that porch, watching his grandchildren play on the beach and looking across the water to the place where he was born into slavery, but now lives at his golden years.
Absolutely.
In freedom.
Absolutely. And that's part of the legacy, that's part of the history. And if you come to the beach and you look up on the second floor, you'll see what we call a crow's nest that was built specifically to do exactly what you said, Governor.
Yeah, it's a very neat place.
I'm part of his spirit, no doubt is there.
Pardon me?
I'm part of his spirit, no doubt is there.
Yes.
Now, we will soon be, thanks to Eddie and Sylvia Brown's generosity, putting a full-length portrait of Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. installing it in the reception hall at Government House.
Wow.
And that will be on September 15th. It will be the first image for all of the images of famous Americans in these historic buildings. That will be the first one in Government House of a black person.
Wow.
So that will be pretty cool.
I think so.
All right. The treasurer moves approval of item 20, seconded by the comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. And that was also, I'm sorry, was it 21A also?
No, that was the whole item 20.
Okay.
A and B. So I don't think we had anybody here for the Wilson Farmstead.
No.
Okay, so yeah, the entire item 20.
Okay, item 20 is approved. Thank you,
good.
Mayor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Matt. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Okay, the balance of the
I just need to withdraw item 21.
Withdrawing item 21, but the balance of the Secretary's agenda. Any questions?
Can I just have a question, Mr. Mack?
Yes.
About 20B, just out of curiosity.
The Wilson Farmstead.
The Wilson Farmstead. The Professional Negro League ball field.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Another thing I should know, but I haven't done. What is the ball field? I mean, if you go there, would you know it was a Negro League ball field?
If you go there now, no, you would not know that it was a Negro ball field unless you're probably from the area and know a little bit about the history of that area. And that's why it's being developed. Yeah. And
so that'll make it clear.
That makes it clear.
So we can also have, I'm dreaming of these maps of Maryland.
Yeah.
And the Negro League was amazingly important. And yeah. Maryland did very well.
Right. That was the center. Exactly. That was the point of center for all of the leagues that we had around throughout the state. And this is the second phase, the first phase that you all approved. This is a continuation of developing that.
Very good. I'd like to see that develop. I mean, great tourists.
And they're doing a great job, right?
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Balance of the Secretary's agenda. Controller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to Department of Natural Resources, Real Properties.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Emily Wilson with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. First, if I may, Governor, on behalf of the Department, we certainly do appreciate your kind words to employees of the Department of Natural Resources. I certainly share that sentiment, although probably perhaps a little biased, but it is a special place, so thank you.
Thank you. A minute.
In a few minutes, we are going to have a slew of rural legacy sponsors coming in for one of our items, but we do have 11 items on the agenda. We are withdrawing item 11A. Item 9A is our FY15 rural legacy awards, a little over $16 million for 18 rural legacy areas across the state. It also includes two expansions. This is enough to preserve, on average, around 4,500 acres. Through the life of the Rural Legacy Program, we've been able to permanently conserve 80,000 acres, almost 30,000 in this administration alone. We are so thankful of the support of this program, and we have terrific sponsors all across the state. There are 31 rural legacy areas total across the state, and these are the folks who really have, quote-unquote, the boots on the ground. This is a truly grassroots program where they are working locally, land trusts and our local governments, with folks in these targeted rural legacy areas to permanently conserve working landscapes across the state. So we do have a slew of those awardees here today in support. And if it's okay, I think they might like to get a picture as well.
Sure.
So, thank you.
Do you want to go through them individually, or do you have a list?
Well, there's 18.
Okay.
So.
Well, they all came. Why don't we call out their name?
Okay. What? Sure. That's fine. If all the sponsors are here, you want to start.
No.
So we have Rob Edkin from the Ag Security Corridor. Barbara Polito, I believe, might be here from Anne Arundel South, but if not, Mark Airdy's here as well. Bill Amos from the Deer Creek Rural Legacy Area in Harford County. Jen Powers from Gunpowder. Rob Gunter and Donna Landis from Land's End, Queen Anne's County. Henry Pitts from Manor in Baltimore County. Ann Bradley from Mid-Maryland Frederick. Chris Briggs from Mid-Maryland Washington. Commissioner Bill Valentine, Mountain Ridge, Allegheny County. Liz Zucker, Nanticoke, Rural Legacy Area. Janine Nutter from Prince George's, Patuxent Prince George's. Ned Halley and Ann Jones from Piney Run. Frank McKenzie from Quantico, and Stephen Ball from Zakiya.
Let me move that between you, and then let's all come up in front of these chairs. Everybody, come on up to the table. Come on up, flush against the table. We'll get more people in and kind of hold them shoulder over shoulder. This is great stuff. Thank you all for what you're doing to preserve Maryland's lands, rural legacy lands, for the future. Ned Halley, thank you for your leadership.
Ned Halley is the chairman of our Rural Legacy Advisory Commission.
As well he should be. Great appointment. It's also an outstanding warrior.
We're almost
here. Jim Smith, you know about a lot of these places, right? They're all in that... beautiful swath of your county, the smart zoning preserved for future generations.
Okay. We're almost there. Okay, in the back, make sure we can see you.
Okay,
like this way.
All over.
Congratulations. That's great. Okay, very nice. Good smiles. And again, very good.
Mr. Controller, you have a motion? Motion to approve? Treasurer seconds. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. It was unanimous and then with an echo and stereo.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Edward, thanks a lot, man. This was very cool.
Good to see you. Talked to our friend Becker the other day. So how many acres in total was that?
This, the funding for this is able, on average, to preserve about 4,500 acres across the state.
Wow.
Yeah. So and these are all projects ready to go.
Cumulatively or just in what we approved today?
Just today.
Just today, mm-hmm. It's 4,500 acres.
It can't, yeah. So we will bring back individual projects throughout the year.
A this farm, mostly?
Farms and forests, working landscapes.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that Deer Creek RLA is one big... rural legacy area.
It is. It's very ecologically significant. Deer Creek is actually a scenic river in Maryland.
Does a river run all the way through there?
Deer Creek. Bill, do you want to elaborate on Deer Creek?
Tell us about Deer Creek.
This is Bill Amos. He's our local sponsor for the Deer Creek Rural Legacy Area.
I'd be glad to. We got two really nice farms. We're getting a tremendous discount on purchasing those easements. Both those properties are very productive farmland, but also a great connection for forest corridors, environmentally sensitive areas on it, like wetlands and stuff. So they're very two really nice farms we're preserving in Harford County and Deer Creek Rural Legacy Area. So.
And does Deer Creek run through it? I mean, it's actually a navigable... Is it navigable?
Well, we canoe on it every spring. So if you want to come up, we'll have a canoe for you.
But only in the spring?
No, all year long. But typically, you know, we enjoy, you know, it's a fishing, trout, canoeing, that river from one end of the county to the other. And it exits at Susquehanna State Park. So
there are a lot of rocks in it?
There can be, yes, in sections of it.
Uh-huh.
But it's a great corridor. We've done a lot of preservation thanks to you. And we've also have our county program active in that area, and we've preserved a lot of land mm-hmm. in our Deer Creek Rural Legacy areas.
It's a very active area.
Yes.
Where's the easiest upstream access?
There's plenty of places to put in and exit. Depends on how much time you want to spend on the river. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we have a lot of nice anchors from parks, whether state or county, throughout the sections of the Deer Creek. and, of course, mixed in with a lot of productive agriculture. So it's a great.
And it empties into the Susquehanna.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Got to check that out.
Check it out. Okay. Come on up.
Questions?
Mr. Amos, you're Bill Amos of Harper County?
Yes, Dad was Senator Amos, yes, yes.
And Delegate Amos.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Years, yeah. My regards.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your support over the years. It's great, a team effort, so preserving.
That was very good. There were many that said at the recession we couldn't afford to preserve Maryland for the future.
Yes.
And you guys never gave up, so thank you for hanging in there.
Thank you.
And being advocates and making such progress. We actually, by sticking with open space and rural legacy, we made more progress, given the economics of the downturn, in the downturn, than we might have in a boom time when values were inflated.
Yes, we're paying about a third of what we used to pay right at the boom time. So it's
covering a lot more acreage.
A lot more acres. And, you know, and we have more individuals. Most of our farmers are now very interested, waiting in line to come in. It's a great opportunity. So, great opportunity.
I think a combination of low interest rates and a growing appreciation of seriously appreciation of the environment, mm-hmm. and the fact that we are facing environmental challenges unlike what we faced before, combined with a tradition in Maryland of educated and dedicated land management, I think, has really, you know, come together synergistically at a great, great moment in time.
Yes.
And the Amos family has always been a great.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Did we approve this? Yeah, we already did. We did it unanimously and in stereo. Department of Budget and Management.
Thanks. Governor, if I could, before we get to that,
sure.
I happen to have had a Labor Day petition put on my desk, and I'd be honored to have the governor, if he so wishes.
Is every page sign identical? Do you want to sign on the front?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm on board. So it is written, so it should be. If you have a petition that doesn't start summer until October, I'll sign that too. Okay, Department of Budget and Management.
Governor, Manager, Mr. Comptroller, good morning. There are 16 items on the Department of Budget and Management's agenda for today. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Mr. Comptroller.
Item 5.
Okay. Item 5, a request that we have retroactive approval of a contract to provide a complete assessment of English language arts, literacy, and math for students who in grades 3 through 8 and English for high school students. The superintendent is here, Dr. Lowry, if you have questions.
Okay.
Yes.
Good morning, Governor O'Malley, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. This is a service contract that is housed in the Division of Curriculum Assessment and Accountability in the Maryland State Department of Education. It is the PARC Operational Assessment System. And this retroactive contract will provide a complete assessment system, including things like test development, reporting, standard setting, for the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Career in English Language Arts, Literacy, and Mathematics for students in grades 3 through 8, algebra, and English for high school students. The award is to Pearson Incorporated. It is a 4-year contract from July 1st, 2014 through June 30th, 2018. In the amount of $59,574,623. It is sole source. The MBEA participation is 3.75%. The agency is requesting this contract because we have joined a consortium of states to develop an assessment that will give us common ways of looking at student performance from state to state and benchmarked internationally and nationally. This began with our entry into the Race to the Top Award, and this part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 actually provided money to states to come up with a common assessment system, and we are now one of 12 states that participate in PARC, 12 states in the District of Columbia. All of the states are members of the PARC Governing Board, but as you know, Maryland is also the fiscal agent for the consortium. And to put that in context, particularly about this contract, New Mexico let this response for proposal for the consortium, just as Rhode Island is in the process of letting a contract for the project management, and Maryland serves as the fiscal agent. So what we decided as a consortium was to share the responsibility for the management of the consortium as equally as we possibly could. So each state took a part of the responsibility. This particular contract sits with an RFP that was led by New Mexico on behalf of the consortium. In 2013, the consortium decided to authorize our governing board to develop and implement multiple components of an assessment system. And we wanted a single vendor, and this was a competitive solicitation process. Well, while it was a competitive solicitation process, only one offeror responded to the RFP, and that was NCS Pearson Incorporated. So by May 2014, the process was completed, and it will last, based on the contract that was negotiated, through June 2018. Now, this is sole source because we are part of the consortium. And being a part of the consortium brings with it great benefits. One, costs. We can lock in on a cost, and even going with a base cost for the test, Maryland took the flexibility of options. We wanted to make sure that we maintained what we already had, and because there were new and more efficient ways of looking at work and assessing how data can inform what we do, we looked at other options. And even with those other options, at the end of the day, we will still be paying less for this assessment than we have for the previous assessment for the contract that just ended. It also gives us actionable data. We had an assessment before that could give us basic proficiency rates for all of our students, but we could not disaggregate by item. So fourth grade teachers knew that in math, we weren't as proficient as we would have liked, but they couldn't really drill down and determine exactly where students were or not performing well. With this new assessment, we can go item by item and give teachers actionable data so that they can structure their teaching and learning, and their leaders can structure their professional development in a more targeted, cost-efficient way. And then the other piece is the scope of work. As I said, there's a basic contract with a basic price, but it offers us the opportunity to also enhance based on the needs that we have specifically for Maryland so that we give full service to our teachers and leaders and give good reporting to our parents and community at large. And most important is that it is a performance-based assessment. So now not only do we discern if students know the right or wrong answer, we can actually look at the logistical steps students took to get to that right or wrong answer. So that, too, helps teachers and leaders in their planning for instruction, professional development, how we target our resources. This is retroactive because there was a challenge to the contract by another vendor, and as I would like to reiterate, only one vendor offered a response, so we were moving ahead based on that information. There was a stay, and we have both attorneys from Maryland, the Maryland State Department of Education legal staff, and Pearson here today, if you would like to drill down more into the legal aspects of this, and we also have staff here from the department. I would like to also assure you that as New Mexico was going through the negotiation process for this particular assessment, we had a Maryland representative every step of the way as a participant in that planning of the evaluation assessment and the negotiation process. So Maryland was well apprised of every decision along every step of the way as this evolved. I also want to talk about a sense of urgency. The reason this is retroactive because we were moving in good faith along the process to get to go when the stay was implemented by the court in New Mexico because the state originally said that the RFP was not timely and that so they dismissed the initial challenge. The court said, I want you to determine based on merits, not on timeliness. And so when based on merits it was vetted, they had sided on the side of the consortium to move forward. The stay was lifted and so we can move forward. There is a sense of urgency, particularly in Maryland. We have some schools who have something called a 4x4, our high schools. So they really operate like a college campus. Students take four courses at the first semester, and they finish those courses. And then they take four courses the second semester. So they can get up to eight courses within a year. We want timely and actionable data, first for parents, so they know how their students perform, but also for our teachers. So those students will have to be ready in November to take their, if you will, end of course assessment. And time is of the essence. Our high schools are adamant about that. They bought into this because we know that we were going to be able to give them that option so that a student who finishes a course in December doesn't have to wait until May or June to take an assessment. We also field tested this PARF assessment with this particular field test and administrative platform with all of our teachers across the state, every school in the state except for seven, and those seven had to give the full battery of state assessments because they get school improvement grants for the federal government, so they had to have formalized data on each of their students. But we actually have our teachers and leaders who have ensured, because this is a technology-based assessment, that they have the compatible devices. Many of our districts have gone out and invested in technology to ensure that, to the greatest extent possible, this can be a completely online assessment as soon as possible. I will end by saying we have 3 years to get to full technology capacity. And when we get to full technology capacity, we will cut the cost of what we have been historically paying for our assessments in the state of Maryland by about 25%. That is with the base pay, and that is with additional options that will enhance what we can and cannot do on behalf of our students and our teachers.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. I do have a few questions since it is, as you mentioned, a retroactive four-year, just rounded off, $60 million contract to NCS Pearson out of Iowa City, Iowa. And as you mentioned, it was a single bid contract. So I understand the importance of the development and implementation and administration of the PARC assessments. They've caught everybody's eye that are going to be administered not only to the students in our state, but also, I take it, to students in the consortium in our states. So, but it is a rather unique procurement, and there are far-reaching impacts in the classrooms for our state. So I would like to just ask a few questions about the status that we have as the fiscal agent for the consortium. You mentioned that the consortium decided to route the vendor selection process through the state of New Mexico and therefore use New Mexico's procurement system. How similar or dissimilar is the New Mexico public procurement system to the one that we use here in Maryland?
If I may call Chrissy Michael up, and she may be able to give some information about that. And if I, while Chrissy is coming up, Mr. Comptroller, if I may point out, The fiscal agency and the operational assessment, RFP, in New Mexico are two completely different entities. Certainly, we'll answer the question as to our best ability now, and if not, get back to you later on the differentiation between the procurement laws. But we, as a state of Maryland, pretty much pay the bills. We don't get into the rudimentary logistics of this work. That is a New Mexico responsibility.
So we do know that New Mexico is required to competitively bid their procurements. Other than that, we can get back to you on the basics of their procurement law. The reason that we're here today with a sole source contract is that we felt it was our responsibility to follow Maryland's procurement law. So we're using the price agreement established in New Mexico, but we are doing our own specific Maryland contract with Pearson.
Okay, and since you're up here, I noted that we were on the technical evaluation team for the selection of Pearson, but we were not on the price negotiation team. I guess Illinois, Massachusetts, Mississippi, and New Mexico were on that. Wouldn't, as the fiscal agent for the consortium, it be expected that we would be on the price negotiation team?
So with the fiscal agency, what we pretty much do is make sure, and we have our two attorneys here, Liz Kameen is our lead attorney, and Lydia Hoover is the one who is specialized in procurement. We make sure that they have followed the laws of based on the memorandum of understanding that we have written with the consortium. But let me talk to you about how the process works. Even though we didn't technically sit in the private negotiations around the pricing, I, as a representative of the state of Maryland, am on the executive team for the consortium. The state's on the governing board, but there are five states that sit on the executive team. I represent Maryland on that executive team. Before any pricing goes to anyone to negotiate, it all comes to the executive team. We have a standing call that I missed this morning, and one of my staff took for me every Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock to talk about what is going on to update us so that we can make collective decisions for the negotiation team to go back to the room.
No, right. But you, I think you mentioned earlier that you thought this was a good price or deal.
Right.
Because I think what you said was it was lower than the previous contract, but how do we know if it wasn't really, if there weren't multiple bids, that this is the best we could have done?
Well, we had to go with the proposal offer that we had, and we certainly know that at the end of the day, we will be paying 25% less than we have been paying. We could deal only with the information and the opportunity that we had at hand, and that's what we did and negotiated in good faith to get the best price.
And who had the
I mean, please know that we did research around assessments. All 12 states give assessments, so we know what price points were. We know what they were paying to their particular vendors to give their state assessments. And the team and the attorneys representing the states engaged in lots of research as we went along.
Okay. And who was the incumbent or the person that had the – what company had the contract before?
So we have always been with Pearson. We are pretty much with the same vendor. Pearson ETS has
served. So Pearson had a contract that was doing this for 25%.
For Maryland.
For Maryland.
Right. Mm-hmm. The consortium had no vendor before because this is a startup, if you will. The consortium was convened in 2010, and this is the first contract for an assessment that, as a collection of states, we have let.
But you stated that it was lower by 25%
than what the state of Maryland had paid for the previous assessments that we've been giving for the past 10 years.
Sounds like we were paying too much, don't you think?
Well, we certainly aren't going to be paying that much going forward.
Okay, let me just understand what the fiscal agent entails. I understand that we are, that responsibility is with us, but does it come with any administrative or operational?
Yes, sir. We receive staff for that.
Yes, we have four staff that are paid for through the PARC grant to help administer that program. Our responsibilities include paying bills on behalf of the consortium because the grant itself from the U.S. Department of Education could not be granted directly to PARC, Inc. It had to go through a state. So it does go through us, and we contract with PARC, Inc., who does the management on our behalf.
Okay. So just so I get a handle on the timeline, I understand the consortium awarded the contract to Pearson in May, and Maryland was set to bring it before the Board of Public Works for our approval in July, the Maryland part. But then, as you mentioned, another vendor filed a bid protest down in New Mexico. That protest ultimately made its way to the New Mexico District Court onto the desk of the New Mexico purchasing agent before ultimately being denied. So now that protest has been denied, I take it, in New Mexico. We're being asked to award retroactive contract approval since the contract officially began on July 1st. Is that the right?
That's correct, because in order for us to meet the guidelines and the benchmarks as far as time, so that we can give an assessment to our students appropriately and within a definite time frame, one of the things that the courts did allow the Pearson to do is to continue the work. So once the stay was lifted, they could continue the work while other things were being negotiated between the challenger and the state. So we have to pay them for their services. Now, we're asking for a retroactive payment because we are being, as Christy Michael said, as transparent as we possibly can. This is $60 million. We didn't want to do an emergency sole source. We wanted to have a public discussion about this so that we are completely open with everyone. But some of the other states, while they may not go retroactive, will just bill them. They will still have to pay Pearson for the fees, even though they may go forward from the time of the date certain for the contract. They will still have to write a check to pay Pearson for the portion of the work that was done before the contract was.
Okay. But my understanding is Pearson's been doing this work.
Yes.
Long. Okay. Yes. And then the question I have is, why didn't you bring this to the board meeting on July 23rd or August 13th?
Well, one of the things we wanted to make sure it happened is we had all the pricing done. We were going to bring it earlier, and, of course, DBM did exactly what they were supposed to do and said when we came before you, they wanted all as much possible, the I's dotted, the T's crossed. They wanted to be able to present to you a complete package, a complete history, a complete financial
okay.
picture.
Now, the $60 million or $59.xx mm-hmm. million, it's classified as 100% general funds, but is that state funds or is that federal funds?
That would be state funds. The Comprehensive Assessment Systems grant from the federal government to the consortium was for the development of the test. But we, like we always have done as a state, are responsible for our operational assessment that is in compliance with the Elementary and Secondary Education Act.
Okay. If I could just ask a general question, because I've visited 150, 175 schools around the state, and I've talked to a lot of parents who have school-age kids, and do you ever get the sense that we are testing too much?
So one of the conversations that we're having as a nation, first of all, thank you for asking that question because I meant to give that piece of information. We have been working with the scope of work because we want to keep these costs from being prohibitive. And we have decreased the amount of time for tests by looking at the forms that we're going to use. And then we have to have a broader conversation because sometimes there is a misunderstanding between what the state requires in assessment and what the local jurisdictions also implement as formative assessment. Now, I will say I support 100% the local jurisdictions because those formative data give teachers actionable data to inform teaching and learning based on real targeted needs. But let's just be perfectly clear here that the state only requires a summative assessment. And the other benchmark informative assessments are decisions made at the local level. We are surveying the local jurisdictions, asking them to look at what assessments they're giving additionally, and to determine if those are the right assessments. Do they need to give those assessments? Do they need to give them as frequently? So it is a combination of both state and local decision points that we have to review and assess as we go forward.
Okay. Because I happen to believe that we're entering into a realm where we're teaching to the test rather than teaching kids what they should be learning to get ready for the workforce or get ready for college. And you know, over the weekend, I played Trivial Pursuits with my wife and son-in-law and daughter. And the question that sticks in my mind is, what state other than Indiana, what two states other than Indiana do not recognize daylight savings time? Well, I noodled on that and gave the wrong answer. It turns out it's Arizona and Hawaii.
Thank you for not asking me.
Yes. Absolutely, yeah. You would have been like me, Kentucky, you know, Tennessee or something. But sure, I know that. If I see it on a test somewhere, I'm going to get it. Is it useful information? Probably not. So that's one concern, that the obsession with testing, it's very politically correct, I guess, to require accountability through testing, is getting in the way of what kids should be learning. That's number one. And number two, getting back to this Labor Day petition that I'm circulating, people say, gee, we need more time to teach our kids, Mr. Comptroller. You're getting in the way of the what we need to inform our kids about it in order to have them prosper. And you talk to any family that's got school-age kids, and that just drives them crazy because they say as soon as the tests are done, learning stops. You have weeks of field trips, field days, soft days. So that's the concern I have, that we have an almost fetish with testing, which is beginning to overtake what you, I'm sure, obviously champion, which is real teaching.
So one first, the standards, the new standards, the new college and career ready standards are conceptually based, focused on analytical and critical thinking skills. It is focused on making connections for students between the theoretical knowledge that we're imparting in the classroom and how that relates to real life in ways that we've never done before. The conceptual understanding also shifts to the child being far more responsible for his or her learning. And I'm sure you've seen it when you've gone in schools. I certainly have. These student-centered classrooms versus teacher-centered classrooms, where teachers really are the facilitator of learning and peers are working together. Our new assessments mirror that kind of teaching and learning. As I said, they're performance-based. It's no longer fill in the bubble, A, B, C, or D. They have to demonstrate their knowledge. They have to show the logistical thinking of getting to a right answer. So I would say if the assessment is going to mirror what we're doing in the classroom based on analytical and higher order thinking skills, teaching to the test really means teaching students to think critically and analytically and being able to demonstrate knowledge that way.
And what about compression of the academic schedule? By the tests being the be-all and end-all, and then there's this 2 to 3 week down period where nothing really, except in rare instances, gets back on the academic train.
And shame on us for using that time in ways that won't be most beneficial. What we are hearing from the business community around our students, not only with the academic skills, but the need for soft skills development, how to work in teams, how to interact and impart knowledge so that people can move forward, understand the product that they are selling or fixing or creating. So we are looking at work-based experiences, internships. There are ways to use time that would be beneficial to students outside of the classroom. So we're talking more and more about partnering with community colleges, universities, businesses at the local level to give children experience. That gets back to the point with these conceptual new standards about making learning relevant. How do we take that theory and help children connect it to the real world? So we, if there is that time available, then we need to help our educators use that time in ways that would be beneficial to students.
Think about me if you're playing Trivial Pursuits.
I will think about you. Sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you did have a student in the last stage.
Okay. People opposed to this? You want to come up and speak?
Mr. McGovern, Mr. Bregman.
Good morning. Tom McGovern. With me is Doug Bregman. We're representing the American Institutes for Research, which is one of the companies that does this type of testing in other states. And the real issue here is, why is the state awarding a four-year, $60 million contract on a sole source basis? Maryland law requires competition. Many companies, including AIR, would love the opportunity to compete for this work. So why isn't it being competed? Well, the answer is that Maryland is piggybacking off of a contract that was awarded by New Mexico. And that's permitted under Maryland statutes, so long as the underlying contract was awarded as a result of competition. Well, the problem was, it wasn't. There were a lot of problems with the New Mexico procurement, not the least of which is that it specified that the vendor had to use the Pearson proprietary software during the first year of contract performance. Obviously gave a little bit of benefit to Pearson. Well, it shouldn't come as a surprise that only one bidder responded to that solicitation. Now, you might think that the situation would have provoked a protest. Well, it did. Prior to the time the proposals were due, AIR objected, said these specifications are overly restrictive. The state wouldn't hear the protest. AIR had to go to court to get the state to entertain the protest. As the superintendent properly pointed out, the court ordered the state to consider the protest, and the protest was denied. Well, it's been represented that that's the end of the story. Well, it certainly is not the end of the story. This is still an active litigation in New Mexico on the merits now. The judge is going to consider the issues on the merits to determine whether or not this contract was competitively awarded. So there's a very good chance that the contract on which the state of Maryland is piggybacking will disappear. So does it make sense to proceed with a sole source procurement when you are not satisfied or can't be satisfied that the competition was fair until the outcome of these legal proceedings? Now, the answer to this question is complete this requirement. Arizona was one of the PARC consortium members. It decided to complete the requirement and not piggyback off of the New Mexico contract. The result? It got six proposals. Six. There are many companies that can do this Common Core testing, including AIR.
Which state was that?
Arizona. At a minimum.
Yes. I remember that.
It wasn't clear what time zone that they were operating in at the time, but I guess standard time since they don't use daylight savings time. In any case, what we recommend is Maryland should defer a decision on this until the litigation is over at a minimum. But the right answer is to compete it. Let other companies compete. You may have a lower price than Pearson charged you in prior years, but you could get a still lower price if this was subjected to competition, which is Maryland's state law. Unless you have any other questions, that's all I have to say.
And what is the litigation timeline?
Well, lawyers are always somewhat reluctant to predict the timeline on which courts will take action, but we expect that the case would be resolved in the next several months. One other point to consider is that the federal government funded two consortiums in order to look at developing common core standards. And the idea was, let's have two different tests so they can compete against one another. So the fact that Maryland is aligned with the PARC consortium doesn't mean that you're tied to the hip with Pearson. Other PARC states have competed their awards, and companies other than Pearson are supplying the PARC testing. So you're not, this isn't a one solution problem.
Just a factual question. I'm trying to understand what the PARC consortium consists of. I thought it was 13 states. Is Arizona one of those 13?
Arizona was a PARC state, but they decided to conduct their own procurement outside.
They're not part of the PARC consortium anymore.
They were actually on the evaluation team. If you look at your agenda,
I'm not arguing. I'm asking a question. They're not part of the PARC consortium anymore, or they are? Or maybe Dr. Lowry. I'm just trying to understand the PARC consortium.
Madam Treasurer, they are no longer part of the PARC consortium. They withdrew.
They withdrew from the consortium altogether. And are all the members of the consortium on board with this procurement?
All the members of the consortium are on board. There were, in some states, debate around the standards and the assessments in order to keep focused on the standards. Some pulled out of the consortium so that the individual state could do their own assessments.
Because they didn't want to be a part of the consortium. Thank you. I was just confused.
But even consortium states like Louisiana have awarded contracts to companies other than Pearson. DRC, I believe, is the company that's doing the testing in that state.
So your testimony is that the Pearson contract that, in effect, we're voting on today, which was... I guess it came to us through the New Mexico system, was flawed at the New Mexico level because they had the specifications so narrow that only Pearson could bid, I take it.
That's what's at issue in the lawsuit. There are other problems. I don't want to bore you with the details, but New Mexico didn't even follow the proper rules for doing cooperative purchasing agreements, which allow other states to use their contract. And when AIR raised that in the appeal to the board, the school official, the senior procurement official, he said, well, only New Mexico is purchasing off of this particular contract. So rather than defend on the merits and say, yes, we did follow the rules, the state's procurement agent said, No, this is just a contract for New Mexico. So that issue is going to be before the court as well.
And, well, thank you. I didn't realize all that, but maybe someone could help me understand if it were deferred, what would happen to the ongoing work of Pearson, I guess.
One point from, I'll let the superintendent speak, but I want to make it clear that
sure.
AIR's intent here is not to deprive students of testing. It's to limit whatever happens to the minimum period of time necessary to get competition in place. So the superintendent mentioned that testing was proceeding in New Mexico. Well, that's because AIR said, let testing proceed for the first year. And when the court makes the decision, we can figure out what's going to happen for the balance of the years on the contract. They didn't want to interfere with the state's plans for testing the students in that year. So it's possible that some sort of compromise could be fashioned here along the same lines. It's not the intent to disrupt. It's the intent to compete.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. As we all know, Maryland is a very smart state with very smart people. And I would like to bring up Lydia Hoover. She's our procurement assessment. Regardless of what happens in New Mexico, we have written language in our contract that the contract that would be approved here today would go forward, period. If I could let Lydia fill in the details.
Yeah, but that's, to me, is a problem, not a solution.
Well, if what it says is that the state of Maryland, although we use the scope of work and the pricing that was negotiated on behalf of the consortium in New Mexico, we still made a Maryland-centric contract that would protect us, our fiscal engagement, and our ability to assess our children in a timely way. If you could let Lydia please speak. Thank you.
I just wanted to address a couple of things. I think that ARR is trying to take this opportunity to really argue its case that it has in New Mexico, and I want to clarify a couple of points about what was going on in New Mexico. AIR filed a bid protest, and their procurement officer decided that the protest was untimely. AIR filed an appeal. The judge found that the protest was indeed timely and stayed all contract proceedings until the procurement officer in New Mexico could issue a decision on the merits of the bid protest. The procurement officer did issue a decision on the merits of the bid protest and denied its protest. That issue is currently on appeal in the district court. The district court proceedings do not stay New Mexico from proceeding with its own contract. New Mexico is actively working on its own contract with Pearson and is actively negotiating with Pearson on its contract. Likewise, because New Mexico isn't impacted, Maryland shouldn't be impacted. And with respect to the sole source that Maryland is doing, there are a couple of points to that. First, the underlying procurement was competitively bid. AIR chose not to submit a proposal because it didn't want to. Maryland.
Well, let me ask, if I could interrupt, was there a requirement in that bid that New Mexico put out and that we're apparently piggybacking on that required the use of Pearson's proprietary software for the first year?
As a contingency, it was, because everyone was aware of the time frames, and the Pearson software was going to be a fallback position, and all vendors knew that whatever they created had to be interoperable with that software, but all vendors were told to propose their own software that had to meet certain interoperability standards, which probably go beyond my level of IT expertise, but there were pages and pages of interoperability standards. And then in addition to that, PARC, Inc., the nonprofit organization that is serving a lot of roles under the fiscal agency contract, is actively bidding out a technology contract for the technology assessment. They have received 5 bids for the technology software that would be competitors and maybe even Pearson. I don't know who the bidders were. That hasn't been disclosed yet. They haven't reached final negotiations, but they did receive 5 bids on that. So Pearson software, there are competitors to that.
Yeah, but surely you're a procurement officer.
No, I'm an assistant attorney general.
But you're involved in procurement law.
Yes.
And you know that one of the biggest complaints about state procurement is that the incumbents or other specialized friends, entities, et cetera, get biased in these RFPs by these kinds of, you mentioned pages and pages and pages of technical software stuff. It sounds to me like it's pages and pages and pages of we want one bid.
No.
And the fact that there's $60 million in general funds, I thought this was federal dollars, so I was a little, well, what the heck, it's someone else's money, right? Hey, this is $60 million of general funds, and you have one bidder. And then you say, well, that's okay because it's the New Mexico system that produced it. And what if that thing was completely slanted towards Pearson, despite everyone's best intentions? Wouldn't you feel a little bit poorly standing up and telling us to spend our taxpayers' money on that kind of a sole, single-bid situation? Or at least not urging us to limit it to 6 months so that we're not... We can actually have something where there are other companies bidding who do the same business?
Mr. Comptroller, if I may, not all the states were Pearson, had Pearson as a vendor. As a matter of fact, I would say most did not. So it wasn't like all 12 states in the District of Columbia were with Pearson and it was slanted toward Pearson. States within the consortium were going to have to change vendors completely. And I do have here with us Trinell Bowman, who was on the actual team, who can probably speak to your question more
directly. Okay.
I guess just one point I would like to raise is that although Pearson was the main contractor for this particular operational assessment, there were other subcontractors who are leaders in the field. There were four additional subcontractors that are part of the Pearson team. So I want you to understand that it's not just Pearson, that there are additional subcontractors that do test development, et cetera, that are part of the contract.
But there's one bid.
Correct.
$60 million.
Correct.
How do we know that's the best price?
I think one of the big pieces that Park was committed to was accessibility and inoperability. So when we talk about the inoperability standards, we're looking at how to actually exchange our items from our item bank onto the platform, et cetera. And so it was very important that we look at accessibility, particularly for students with disabilities, English learners. And so we did have very high demands placed on inoperability standards because we want to be able to assess all students, and we have not been able to do that in prior years, particularly in Maryland, when we think about our different student populations. And so there were a lot of requirements placed on being able to meet the accessibility needs as well as the inoperability of test items for different learners.
Well, I mean, I don't want to go on and on. I appreciate you folks being here. I've never heard of you before this morning. But otherwise, if you weren't here, this thing would be going through with all sorts of, what's the problem? Because it's lower than the last one we paid for. Same company. I mean, I am just stunned that we are so casual in this bidding process that we would allow something like this to be put in front of us when we know there are five or six companies like Pearson that do this work. And yet we come forward with, oh, hey, Uno Company.
If I may, Pearson is here and they wanted to respond.
Can I ask a question about, as I understand, what you're saying is that there are several companies, one of them some of them under Pearson came together with Pearson essentially as a lead contractor and then subcontractor members of a consortium.
That's right.
All right. That's the first thing that you were saying. On the other hand, the way it's being presented, if it had to be interoperable with Pearson, if that's what you're with Pearson specifically, how could other contractors compete? I mean, what they're saying. I mean, how was it competitive?
So I think to Trinell's point, and we can talk to you more in detail with the actual negotiated part, is we built our test. The consortium knew what we wanted. This is the next generation assessment.
So the test is there that you want.
And so we knew the kinds of accessibility tools we wanted. We knew what kinds of immediacy and feedback we wanted. So we wanted a platform that could accommodate all of the things that we needed. And we did describe and prescribe what we wanted and needed. It needed to be interoperable. And so other folks had the opportunity, just like Pearson did, to come forward with some kind of solution.
So it didn't say it had to be Pearson.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
Everybody didn't have to say it has to be identical to Pierce.
Absolutely.
This is a question. I haven't read the...
Absolutely not. And because we are the consumer, we are paying our money to buy an assessment, we wanted to build the assessment that we wanted to build with a certain request.
I respect the treasurer's questions, and I hear your answer, but it's very perplexing to me. Could I at least hear from that other group that brought this issue up? If it has to be interoperable, what does it have to be interoperable with?
Well, that's a good question.
Happy to answer that question.
Yeah.
The problem with the New Mexico procurement was that it was bundled. Basically, Pearson was behind on coming up with the software that everybody is supposed to be able to use. It's open system software. The test items were supposed to be in the public domain. But because Pearson was running behind on development of that software, New Mexico said, okay, for the first year, we're going to use Pearson's proprietary software. And AIR's main problem with that is, well, why bundle a procurement that's going to go on for 5-6 years with a requirement for 1 year to use proprietary software system? Buy it for 1 year and then compete the additional years. Have another 5-year contract to use the open system software that everybody can use. And so,
and
the superintendent...
More, and have more bids.
And have more bids. I think one bid speaks for itself.
If I may Pearson come up and respond to some of
this? Yes,
please.
Absolutely.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I'm Karen Walker with the law firm Apollo Denine. I represent Pearson. The state of Maryland has made an investment in being a member of the PARC Consortium. It's been sitting at the table all along the way while this test has been developed. It's had input in what the test is going to look like, how the test is going to be administered. The state's put its resources of its Department of Education and many of its educators into the PARC Consortium. The PARC Consortium has determined that 12 states will administer an assessment that is consistent in design, items, quality, and that test will be administered across all of those states and the results compared, and there's a benefit of that. There are efficiencies in administration. There's efficiencies in determining that the quality is consistent and comparing the results. The PARC Consortium determined that New Mexico would conduct a procurement to try to select a vendor for the operational assessment. And New Mexico did that pursuant to its own procurement laws. AIR, at the 11th hour on December 11th, when the bids were due on December 30th, filed a protest to the specifications in New Mexico. That protest was initially denied as untimely, but AIR chose not to respond to the New Mexico RFP. And it was an RFP that's based on price and technical responses. Pearson, as already has been mentioned, partnered with many others in the industry to bring to New Mexico what it thought was the best in class for administering the PARC operational assessments. And it's been mentioned, you know, there is an issue in litigation right now. It's actually not litigation. It's technically an appeal. It is in the district court in New Mexico. But there's an issue that was raised in the AIR protest to the specifications about whether the RFP issued by New Mexico required use of the Pearson content development platform in year one. If you read the RFP, it does not require that. In fact, the RFP says that the content development platform vendor had not been identified at the time that AIR filed its bid specifications protest. Remember, the protest that is on appeal is a protest that was filed in December before the bids were even due, and AIR never responded to the procurement. Once that protest was found to be untimely, AIR appealed it. It proceeded through the court system. Ultimately, the judge determined it should be heard on the merits. It was heard on the merits, fully briefed by all parties, heard by the New Mexico State Purchasing Agent. He rightly determined that there was no merit to AIR's specifications protest, and AIR has now appealed that matter. New Mexico did follow its procurement rules. This was procured as a price agreement. It states that on page 1 of the RFP. It states that it is available for other states to use under their purchasing laws, which is what Maryland is proposing to do here today. It is not a situation where New Mexico conducted a procurement that automatically resulted in contracts in multiple states. The appeal is currently pending. AIR is not doing anything to expedite that. That appeal could last months. There is a 30-day period for filing of the record, 30 days for filing of an initial brief, 30 days for filing a response, and the judge can conduct a hearing. In the meantime, PARC operational assessment is moving forward in New Mexico. There's nothing legally to stop that. The stay that was in place for a few months until the protest of the specifications could be heard on the merits has been lifted. So New Mexico is moving forward. Pearson has been working in Maryland to bring your assessment for the 2014-15 school year. The first test will be administered December 1st to high school students. We are ready to proceed with that. And frankly, what AIR is doing is seeking delay and uncertainty that will create inconsistencies with the PARC Consortium that you all have spent so much time and investment in. With respect to Arizona, Madam Treasurer, as you pointed out, Arizona has withdrawn from PARC. It is not a PARC state. Arizona has conducted a competitive procurement. That process is ongoing. It has taken months. It began in July. I believe the award is to be announced in October. There are multiple proposals, but I don't believe any of those have been fully evaluated and determined to meet the technical specifications at this point in time. AIR's representatives mentioned Louisiana. Louisiana, right now, there's a debate going on about whether they'll be involved in PARC or not. And the Louisiana contract is a contract with a company called DRC, which is Louisiana's existing testing vendor. That happens to be a sole source contract. My understanding, it is not a PARC operational assessment as the contract that is before you today would be. Timing is critical here. As I mentioned, there are deadlines that have to be met for the test to be given to your high school students in December, including uploading student information, which begins next week for those exams. There is field testing review that has to be done in September for the spring test administration. So this is not something that can wait or be delayed. We believe that there was a competitive procurement in New Mexico. We believe at the end of the day the court will agree with us there and that that contract will proceed and that this contract should proceed also in Maryland. And I'm available to answer any questions.
One quick one. How can you state that there's been competition?
Well, a competitive procurement doesn't always mean you have more than one bidder. If it's put out there to the market and people are allowed to respond, and that was what happened, and again, Pearson partnered with multiple vendors. AIR could have gone to the market, partnered with multiple vendors, and submitted a response. And the RFP actually, and I think AIR recognizes in their appeal that's filed in New Mexico, it asked for the vendors to submit a proposal that would include use of their content development platform, their software, for all 4 years. And AIR didn't respond at all.
So how was it limited? I don't. Unfortunately, we don't have it before us. If it said that, then how was it limited for the first? Was it limited for the first year?
I mean, this is a debate between, obviously, the parties in the litigation, but the RFP itself does not say that the Pearson content development platform has to be used. In fact, in response to a question that was asked, it said the content development platform provider had not been identified because at the time the bids were due, there was no contract for the content development platform provider.
But there was an understanding of what the content was, consortium members wanted.
There are interoperability requirements, and again, I'm like Ms. Hoover, that's beyond my IT expertise, but my understanding is the interoperability requirements have been known all along since the PARC Consortium began in 2010. They've been out there as the standards have been developed.
And been discussed.
I believe they were part of the Race to the Top grant with the United States Department of Education initially.
The attorney?
You want me to speak to the Anapa
just to clarify what, if you don't mind, I'd like to hear from our people first. Excuse me, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So one of the big inoperability standards that Maryland led the effort on that was part of an enhanced assessment grant out of Minnesota, which is what we call APIP, which is Accessible Item Profile. And so this allows us to be able to tag items individually for students'
right.
needs, so for students who are blind, students who may need American Sign Language support, students who may need some visual organizers. So it allows us to tag items in different ways that we've never been able to do before. And Maryland led that work in 2009 through an enhanced assessment grant. So we take very seriously interoperability. So that's one of the requirements that is included in the RFP, that the vendor had to be able to support the APIP standard, interoperability standard. We also had additional requirements that are 508 compliant requirements, such as the World Wide Web accessibility standards, the usability guidelines. And so we are trying to make sure that we are being fully accessible to students that have different needs.
Right.
And so it is important to us that we have an operability. So that is some of the requirements that were included in the RFP. And again, Maryland, before there was a PAR consortium, was very actively involved in that particular interoperability standard.
Right. Right. Gotcha. Thank you very much. Yeah.
I don't want to argue the entire case before the board today, but I did want to make a couple of points. One is the issue in the litigation is whether New Mexico improperly bundled the requirement for the first year to use Pearson proprietary software. Now, the lawyer for Pearson said the content delivery platform vendor had not been selected. Well, Pearson is the content delivery platform vendor. The only reason they were able to answer that question is because they hadn't actually awarded the contract to Pearson yet. Pearson's own proposal for the New Mexico contract states that it will use its proprietary software package for the first year. So those are just two points
that's
to think
proposal.
About.
That's the proposal, not the RFP.
Yeah, the proposal that was accepted by the state of New Mexico.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what's your name?
Let me introduce, this is Barry Levine from the American Institutes for Research, and he's intimately familiar with the details of the procurement, what AIR offers, and what Pearson offers.
I just want to speak to the specific point of whether it required Pearson's test delivery system. PARC announced in an Indiana RFP for the field test that they would use the same content delivery system for the field test as they would for the first operational year, the first year of this contract you're being asked to approve. Throughout 2000, that was in late 2012, throughout 2013, PAR continually issued guidance that said, we are driven by compatibility, by your hardware, driven by compatibility with Pearson's test delivery system called TestNav, which will be used for the first operational year, 2014-15. Another point in the litigation is that there may have been a conflict of interest between PARC and Pearson. On December 4th, unknown to AIR, before we submitted our protest on December 11th, before December 30th proposals were due, PARC submitted submissions to both Arizona in response to an RFI and Florida in response to a proposal that said Pearson's test delivery system will be used during the first operational year. It didn't say the same one as the field test. It identified Pearson. And in fact, in the Florida proposal, PARC referred to Pearson as their test delivery partner. In Pearson's proposal on December 30th, Pearson acknowledged the RFP requirement to use Pearson's test delivery system. The RFP did include a contingency for the offeror to provide their own test delivery system. However, the evaluation criteria were to be on the main part, which was to deliver the system using Pearson's test delivery system.
Madam Secretary. So if I may reiterate, it was a competitive process. We put the protocols, the criteria in the RFP that we needed people, to which we needed people to respond. AIRs chose not to respond. They chose to wait until after the process to contest the actual response. Number two, but if we talk about practical, just practical matter, of course, if our teachers are moving to a new assessment, we are going to field test the platform that they will use with their students the next year. Why would we field test one platform and then when we're ready to launch for an entire state, come up with something completely new and different? And it was a great experience through the field test, but we learned a lot. We learned where our areas of strength were, and we learned where our areas of needed improvement, the purpose of the field test, not just the content items, but how this interoperability and the technology platform would work and give our teachers a level of comfort as we move in. So we certainly affirm what you're saying, is that the platform that we use for field tests is now the one that we will use with the first year. And then thirdly and finally, I would like to reiterate the comment from Pearson. We wanted someone to respond to us with a platform. Obviously, this is a kind of brave new world for some of our assessment vendors, and we had to have an assessment for this year. Pearson came with a solution. AIR did not choose to bid nor come with a solution. So that's why we ended up where we are.
If I could just interrupt, that's fine. I can see that assessment. But why didn't anybody else? You have one person before us for a four-year, $60 million contract. It is the opposite of competition that you're presenting to us.
We have one person. We have one vendor who, by the way, has now partnered with others, and I think AR certainly could have been one of those, partnered with other vendors to get the assessment to the deliverable that we, the consortium, wanted. So AR certainly could have been part of the bundle, if you will, to help us get this done.
One bid.
Well, we are the consumer, and we wanted the assessment that we wanted, and they responded.
Not responding to an open bid is also responding to an open
That's
bid.
That's right.
Are we done with this?
Let's look up the definition of competition and see if that's in there. Anybody got a Google there?
There are many,
that's a new one.
Mr. Comptroller, there are many instances where people don't respond to the bids and then come in back door and say, golly, we would have responded if only if you had had terms more favorable to us or if you weren't asking so much of
us.
And
there are lots of instances where contracts, for despite our best intentions to have a good, efficient government run, are articulated in such a way that there's only one bidder. And this sure sounds like one of them. I wish it weren't, because it involves our kids, and it's a lot of money. And anyway.
Any other questions?
Nope.
Okay.
I have no move
ahead. Treasurer, most favorable, second by the governor. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye.
Emphatic.
All opposed?
No.
The comptroller records an emphatic no. That would be one with his hand raised on the tray.
With a one.
We now move on to the balance of the Department of Budget and Management agenda. Any other questions on the balance of the agenda?
If I just ask a question, quick question on question four, Dr. Sherson.
So, item four is a contract to provide administrative services, an administrative services organization in the behavioral health system. The secretary is here along with Deputy Secretary Thomas Kim.
And a few others.
And other members from the department.
I'm sorry, tell me the item again.
It's item four, Governor.
Item four. Mr. Secretary.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, thank you for the opportunity to discuss this procurement. I'll speak briefly to the procurement process that led to today's recommendation of award to Value Options. This procurement started over 3 years ago when the state embarked on its effort to overhaul its behavioral health delivery model. The development of specifications for an RFP included the establishment of a DHMH steering committee, which conducted 24 public meetings to evaluate various delivery models. It also held an additional 6 public stakeholder meetings when the options were narrowed. and produce a 310-page report to the General Assembly on the progress in designing a new delivery model. A couple points. The RFP was let out on February 4th, 2014. Potential offerors had 56 days to respond. Two qualified bids were accepted for consideration. Value options scored higher in both technical merit and in price. Over the five-year contract period, value options was lower in cost by $25 million. Value options committed MBE participation is 21%, or 3% higher than the posted MBE goal. While we feel confident in the steps that were taken to procure a new health service model, we understand that there are those who question the policy decisions that were made during the summer of 2013. Secretary Sharfstein will address these concerns. Also present is Deputy Secretary for Behavioral Health, Dr. Gail Jordan Randolph. Susan Tucker, the Executive Director of Medicaid Systems, Operations, and Pharmacy, will also address any questions as to the Department's ability to implement a new delivery service contract.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer, Governor. This contract is a major step forward for health in Maryland. Currently, there is no rational or coherent system for funding medical substance abuse and mental health care. We have a hodgepodge of funding streams that does not serve the complex patient well. Under this contract, by bringing together payment for mental health and substance use treatment for more than 1.2 million people in our state, Maryland will finally be able to make sure individuals who suffer from both mental health conditions and substance use disorders receive the right kind of care. We'll be able to assess and enforce high-quality standards across behavioral health. We'll develop a common data platform for mental health and substance use treatment across the state. And we'll be able to implement innovative projects targeting specific populations, including individuals at high risk for overdose, those recently released from prison, individuals with significant medical illnesses. For example, we'll be able to, if there's a particular type of patient that we're particularly focused on, we can identify them and work immediately across the entire behavioral health treatment system to coordinate their care, the homeless, children at risk for school failure, and others. The contract supports integrated care for patients. Currently, medical care is funded through multiple means. We have 8 different managed care organizations, a fee-for-service system, and Medicare, covering a number of our patients. The Administrative Services Organization, which is the contract today, is a platform that can be directed to provide comprehensive support for integrated programs. Just as one very concrete
example. If I could just interrupt, sure. Unless the other members really want to hear,
sure.
All of this. Kind of aware of a lot of what you're describing.
Okay.
My question is, there are some major players in the medical field, like Hopkins and MedStar, and national groups representing psychiatric disorders and alcoholism patients, et cetera, that had, I think, significant objections to the model that you're suggesting here. Those all been worked out?
In reverse order, we have here representing the patient groups, both for mental illness and substance use disorders, in support of the procurement. We have, and they can speak to more than 100 groups that have come together. This was all presented during the legislative session. We had the RFP during the legislative session. Our budget incorporated this, that we would be doing this RFP during the legislative session.
We've been pursuing this, safe to say, for about 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, and
with all due respect, we were looking before Dr. Sharfstein joined us.
Nice.
We were searching for better ways to take better care of those citizens who suffered so greatly and cost everyone so much money, being played back and forth across the ping pong net between mental health and drug treatment, such as we were able to provide, not to mention their own physical challenges, given the rigors of those other diagnoses. So it predated Dr. Sharfstein, but go ahead, Doc.
So I think that we've had a very inclusive public process, and the vast majority of people are supportive from that. It is true that Johns Hopkins is not, and has expressed concerns primarily around the their managed care organization within the Medicaid program, and the fact that right now some substance abuse is funded through managed care organizations, and we would be taking that funding and putting it towards this cohesive platform for both mental health and substance use treatment. We think that even at Hopkins, fewer than 40% of the or 50% of the patients that they see with severe mental illness are in their managed care organization. It is very much our belief that they will be able to do get more to integrate care for all the patients they're seeing in the public system, and well beyond the fraction that are in their managed care organization. So we think that I appreciate their interest and some of the progress that they made. We think this approach will be able to accelerate it. And we have enthusiastic support from many people in the system.
Well, that's good, because I'm told that in addition to Hopkins, folks that have reservations are MedStar Health, Maryland Addictions Directors Council, National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, Maryland Psychiatric Society, and also some community-based service providers who had objections when all this was brought out. The only question I have is, have their concerns been met? Mm-hmm. And
The National Coalition for Alcohol and Drug Dependence wrote a letter of support. So I would be...
Then the final question I had was, the governor references a long time ago that he's been working on this. I remember the hospital over on the Eastern Shore that, over my objection, we closed. Right. And I think at that point you were saying we're going to get rid of all these state-run facilities and move everything over to rural hospitals, et cetera. Is that not
true? That was before my time. So I'm going to turn to Dr. Jordan.
Good afternoon, Madam Treasurer, Governor, Comptroller. The Upper Shore was closed 5 years ago. In an effort to expand community-based services for the population in the community of the Eastern Shore, we transferred that money to the community, which allowed for expansion of crisis services on the Eastern Shore, residential rehab services on the Eastern Shore, assertive community treatments for the Eastern Shore, and diversion programs on the Eastern Shore for the local detention centers. So in an effort to expand access to lower levels of care, and to support collaboration and communication on the shore, that money from the Upper Shore was transferred to the Eastern Shore for service agencies.
That policy was successful.
It is successful, and it continues to grow.
And are we doing it in other areas around the state?
We have expanded access to crisis services. We've enhanced access to assertive community treatment teams. We, through our existing ASO, actually has an intense care management project that follows high utilizer programs. We share data. We share authorizations data and claims data. We also, through Value Options Maryland Link, through the Department of Public Safety, through Data Link, to ensure collaboration and communication for continuity of care for people that get arrested. We also have a collaboration with the Department of Rehab Services, again, through Value Options, in terms of linking and sharing information. This is all in existence, and it plans to be expanded with the new contract.
And we're closing the mental health centers like the Upper Shore? Just like that?
The Upper Shore was closed. There are no plans to close any other state facilities.
Well, that's cheap. But I thought that was the policy. We're going to close Upper Shore and give the money to the community, and that's a better policy.
Well, the intention was to expand access to lower-level services to reduce the over-reliance on inpatient and hospital-level of care, and it worked. And so people receive services where they live, as opposed to in a hospital.
Yeah, I would just add two things. One is that in Dorchester County, the Health Enterprise Zone has a major focus on crisis intervention. And also, I think that the broader issue that you're raising comes together quite a lot with the criminal justice system, because if you look at who is actually served in our psychiatric hospitals, the vast majority of them are involved in the courts in some way. So ideally, we would be able to, in general, have a lower inpatient footprint, but that's a much more complex issue because of the courts.
Gotcha. I'm fine.
Any other questions, Madam Treasurer? No? Yes? Okay. Let's hear from those who want to be heard in opposition to this one.
Nobody.
Okay. We good on this one?
Mm-hmm.
Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on to the balance of the Department of Budget Management agenda item. Balance. Any questions on the balance of the Department of Budget Management agenda items?
No. Move approval.
Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. Okay. We now move on to the University System of Maryland agenda item. University System of Maryland.
Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have three items on today's agenda. I'd be happy to address any questions.
Move approval.
Controller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Information Technology.
Good afternoon. I'm Greg Urban with the Department of Information Technology. Thank you, Mr. Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. We have three items on the agenda today. I'd be happy to answer any questions for you. I do want to point out on item one, it lists an MBE participation of none. There will be MBE participation at the task order level underneath the master contract.
Okay.
Mr.
Comptroller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you.
We move on now to the Department of Transportation, the ever patient Jim Smith.
Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Jim Smith representing MDOT. MDOT is presenting nine items. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on this? Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to doing great service. Al Collins.
Good afternoon.
Department of General Services, even more patient than Jim Smith.
good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Governor, thank you for those great words. We do great service. Al Collins, Secretary of the Department of General Services. We have 22 items on our agenda. We're glad to answer any questions you have on these items.
I think it was all clear. Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. And that concludes our agenda. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.